I said about appetites.
The Master. Davy had taken the news of his promotion more calmly than Caroline. As so often, the first hint had come in bed from Ella, who had rolled over and was staring at his face as if she had never seen it before, with a serious expression. Her mouth twisted in a way he found erotically exciting. So, forewarned, he had taken the trouble to flatter Ulwin Grimaldi and had listened patiently to a pep talk from Murdoch White, mainly on the subject of always taking the credit for successes and moving on briskly from failures, which should always be attributed to the civil service or to one's predecessor, or, if they were huge, to the situation left behind by the previous government. Davy wondered whether the unseemly pleasure he took in the trappings of his new position, the magazine profiles, the larger car and its driver, the more intelligent and attentive private secretaries, was some kind of petty revenge on his father, who, for all his energy, had never moved beyond a smoky open-plan office in the services of the local cab company. Certainly the higher he climbed, the less intrusive he found his father's memory was. He would have liked to discuss this with Mary, but when they met these days, there never seemed to be time to do anything other than deal with family administration. In any case, she didn't seem much interested in his London life. That life now revolved around the twin poles of his hectic office and Ella's flat. Some weeks he seemed to be at her place more often than his own, but still the secret held. Every fortnight he'd pick up Private Eye with an almost pleasurable shiver of unease. But nothing ever happened. Ella had thawed a little, but far too slowly to satisfy Davy's gnawing hunger for intimacy. For he was not a cold man. He thought a lot about Fergus and Callum and quite a lot about Mary. But he had come to regard them as interesting, distant friends. Mary existed up north, but London was not her town, hardly her planet. Different planets, different rules. When he was back in Glaycott, it was as if he'd never been away. Familiar accents, the different smell of the air, muck and bray freshness, coal fires, burning stubble, and the feel of his sons' heads on his lap as they watched telly together. All of this washed over him like an out-of-body experience or a pleasurable dream. So he sank into it and thought very little of his office or of Ella. In London, things were different. His heart, that unruly riot of gristle and tubing which seemed so much more than a mere pump, flailed against his ribcage as he left Ella's flat. "Got away with it," it said. "Got away with it, got away with it, gotta. And remarkably, so they seemed to have done. Everybody else got caught. Parliamentary private secretaries and cookery writers, the husbands of ministers and the wives of secretaries of state, researchers and eminent authors. The press and the scurrilous websites found, week after week, further proof of the scandalous fact that sex happened, and not always inside marriage. Yet David Petrie, who was a rising minister in an unpopular government, would have been a fat and juicy target, and the mysterious Ella James, already connected in the public mind to her employer, the Master, were never photographed together, never recorded. Apparently, they were never even seen. In part, this was due to what Ella coldly called her tradecraft. They could walk together through the centre of London, but Davy would be on one side of the road and Ella on the other. They made eye contact and exchanged complicit smiles, but always from a distance, unphotographable as a couple, divided by traffic. They chose separate tube carriages and seats a few rows apart on buses. At parties, they would enter separately and make a point of introducing themselves to each other, competing to see whose false politeness was the more ridiculous. Davy sometimes wondered whether this no-contact public game pointed to a deeper truth about their relationship. Yet these were the only terms on which it was possible. London in the early years of the 21st century was the most public city in the world and perhaps the hardest to hide in. But even London had its dead spots, its blank triangles. Davy and Ella had become anti-connoisseurs of restaurants and pubs, experienced in finding the about-to-be-closed curry houses with a patina of dirt on the window. The no longer fashionable trattorias were only tourists with 10-year-old copies of Time Out were ever found. The restaurants, which specialised in obscure and unappetising cuisines. In their quest for privacy, they had eaten kangaroo and alligator meat, glutinous Mongolian stews of lamb fat, and insect-stuffed Mexican delicacies. Once, they had even found a Belarusian restaurant. No one else was there, nor, by the look of the place, ever had been. They told one another they were paying for their passion not by being exposed to public shame or poisoned or stabbed by jealous rivals, but by becoming slightly pasty-faced, badly fed, and flatulent. Some of this they walked off late at night. From Green Park to Kensington Gardens, the squares of Bloomsbury to the duller stretches of Regent's Park, every one of the stands of sprawling rhododendrons, tangles of holly and yew and derelict Victorian sheds where wheelbarrows and rollers were locked up, held a memory of their subterranean life together. Davy understood that he was becoming addicted to Ella. She never gave him enough of herself. It was always mere sex. But their games had a human reality that made the struggles of politics tolerable. Yet he knew that she always had the upper hand. At times he wondered if she was really his friend. Had he ever mentioned her to Tony Moretti or his SNP cousins back home, it would have been regarded as proof positive that he'd been corrupted by power. Bunty certainly had never liked Ella. Davy had had to adapt to Bunty's implacable outspokenness on the subject. She had learned to say little when anyone else was in the office. But if she and Davy were alone, Bunty would start up. "Who's the whore?"
"Bunty, that is inappropriate."
"Well, she is a whore. She's got a whorey claws into you, and you're making a damned fool of yourself. Everybody knows. It's only a matter of time before it's on the front of the Sun."
"Nobody knows."
"Everybody knows. Well, leastways, I know."
"Is that a threat, Bunty?"
"No, Mr. Petrie, it's a statement of pure, honest Scottish fact. I don't want to be mean, but do you think the whore wants you for herself? You know exactly what the girls would call an R.W.C.?"
"Now you're being offensive, and I don't even want to know what R.W.C. stands for. Shall we get down to work?"
"Right, wee cracker. Nae offence."
As in so many other areas, Bloody Bunty was turning out to be nothing like a fool. At precisely the moment that this conversation was taking place, the master was licking the last of the champagne strawberry jam off Ella's impressively concave stomach. His brow was furrowed with concentration as he moved towards her pubic hair.
"Hmm. Fortnum's? Waitrose? I'm losing my touch. But I never weary of the taste. How are you getting on with our Mr. Petrie?"
Ella groaned lightly.
"You know I'm your helpless plaything. I'll do anything you want. But I wish you hadn't given me Bloody David Petrie as your project. He is so, so boring."
The master continued to graze. Ella noticed that the liver spots on his back were becoming more prominent. In between light kisses and snuffles, he murmured, "Boring in bed."
"Yes, but that's the least of it. Bed's soon over. No, it's much worse than that. I mean, just boring, boring. The man hasn't got a single interesting idea in his head. He's completely self-obsessed. He just goes on and on about his rivals and his childhood and his position in the party. He never says anything about real politics. He doesn't seem to know what that even means. I have no idea, even now, what drives him. Nothing wrong with being self-obsessed. Not a lot wrong with an absence of clear views. Remember, his purpose is for us to mould him and use him. The last thing I want is for him to strike out on his own, or begin to think that he can. More jam? No, I've got to watch the tummy. Too bad. I still think he's boring, and that's the big problem. You've got the photos. I left them in the top drawer of your desk. So you've got David Petrie where you want him. I'm just not sure he's worth it.
Oh, he's worth it.
Easy for you to say. You don't have to...
I'm sorry. Let me make it up to you.
You are the most vain, most impossible man I have ever met.
I know. And you love me for it.
Whitehall Life,